Seated. Good morning. This morning we have before us John Doe 1 et al. Versus Madison Metropolitan District 20454 and it's 20AP 1032. Appearances, please. Okay. Good morning. All right, then. As I have it, the lineup is Mr. Berg, 25 minutes, Attorney Zylstra, 15 minutes. Vincent, 15 minutes, followed by Attorney Berg, 5 minutes. Okay? All right, then. We're in agreement. Let's proceed. Yep. That sounds good. Justice Rogensack has access to Wisconsin Eye as well, but she needs to exit for a moment.
Luke Berg for the parents. May it please the court. When children begin to struggle with gender dysphoria, there's a major fork in the road. Many experts believe that adults should not immediately affirm that children really are trapped in the wrong body, but instead should help them process and understand what they're feeling and why, and hopefully help them find comfort with the body that they were born with, as most kids who struggle with this do, if they do not transition. Many experts also believe...
I'm gonna stop you right there. Is it your position that any child who may even think about transitioning may suffer from gender dysphoria?
No.
At what point are you using the term dysphoria?
I am using the term gender dysphoria as a broad catch-all for kids who struggle with their gender identity, who wrestle with what is my gender identity, what is my identity.
But a child might be born one gender and then want to switch gender without having dysphoria, correct?
That's true. Yes, that's true. Dysphoria is defined as significant distress associated with that. So I agree if that's the definition of dysphoria. But the mere fact that a child wants to transition is a yellow flag that a child might be dealing with a serious mental health issue. Everybody agrees that dysphoria can be a serious mental health issue. So the first thing that should happen is the parents should be involved to help their child with a professional evaluation, with proper diagnosis, to figure out if the child needs professional help. Because
but changing your name, asking to be called a different name in a school, is not a yellow flag for dysphoria, is it?
It is. Yes, it is. Absolutely it is. If a child is at a point that they want to publicly transition to a different gender identity, that's a strong signal that they might be dealing with a serious mental health issue, and the parents need to be involved. And as I started with, many experts believe that treating a child as the opposite sex can have long-term consequences. It can become self-reinforcing.
Are you done? Can I just make one more point? It's my understanding, actually, that for children who are suffering from dysphoria, that what is helpful for them is for them to be able to transition in a respectful way, that is the medically approved way to address dysphoria.
That is one view. That is not the only view. And there are experts who think that transitioning can actually be harmful for kids. And the answer may depend on the kid. It could be different for every child. For some kids, maybe transitioning is the best thing, but for others, it may actually do harm.
This case really isn't about the medical debate, right, counsel? It's about the fact that your clients have not received a decision on an emergency motion that was filed over 2 years ago. Isn't that why we're here?
Correct. Yes, this case is about preserving and protecting parents' rights to make this decision. It's ultimately about who decides. And this is a major decision. This is a hugely significant decision with long-term consequences. There is a debate in the mental health community about this topic. Even the experts they cite, WPATH, Okay. Acknowledges that this is controversial and that there are different views about this.
Mr. Berg, so I want to build off of what I heard Justice Bradley ask. So an emergency motion, so you filed a lawsuit 2 years after the policy went into effect, asking for a temporary injunction. The circuit court hasn't yet decided that because the circuit court believes that the anonymity motion, which you appealed in an interlocutory appeal, needs to be decided first so that they can so that the court can properly evaluate the harms at play here. And so I'm a little confused. Are you now asking this court to decide the motion that the circuit court will decide once the anonymity motion's done? Is that what you're asking us to do here today?
What we are asking for is an injunction of the policy while this case proceeds to protect parents' rights and to protect children from harm.
So that's the temporary injunction that's pending in front of the circuit court that they will address as soon as this anonymity issue is decided.
The circuit court did rule on our motion. It ruled on not our original temporary injunction motion, but once the appeal was filed, we filed a motion for an injunction pending appeal. The circuit court ruled on that. We partially won, partially lost. We went to the Court of Appeals, asked for an expanded injunction, and the court ruled
on
the injunction question.
Now we're lumping injunctions because an injunction pending appeal is only during the appeal, which is about to be over. After we decide this issue, this part of the appeal is over. So I'm talking about the temporary injunction. You want this court to get to the merits on a temporary injunction that has yet to be briefed, where the other side doesn't know who the parties are, so they may not be able to address harm. The court doesn't know how to yet address harm. And you're using 809.14 sub 1 to say that that's the principle by which you bring it to an appellate court for its first consideration. Is that what I'm hearing?
No, it has been briefed and argued at every single level. We told the court on the record in the trial court, we said, look, what we want is an injunction to protect parents' rights, to protect kids from harm. If we're not going to be heard in this court, we're going to come to the appellate courts and ask for an injunction.
You said it's been briefed. You're saying two things to me. There has been no ability for the other side to respond to your injunction.
That is not true at all. We had a hearing in September. They fully briefed it. They submitted an 80-page brief in the trial court. They have an expert report responding to our expert report. We went back and forth with expert reports. It's been fully briefed both at the circuit court and at the Court of Appeals, and now it's squarely presented to this court.
And it has yet to be decided by any lower court. So when you say squarely in front of this court, you're asking this court for the first instance to decide the issue. Isn't that right?
That's not true. It has been decided by the Court of Appeals.
Counsel, can I intervene a little bit?
Sure.
It seems like you might be two ships passing in the night a little. You filed a complaint. You also filed, which is not uncommon, a request for an injunction that was of an emergent nature, right?
Right, right.
We see those all the time.
Right.
We've seen them over the last several years where courts rule on those and then they come right up asking for different relief from appellate courts and then ultimately ask us to take it and decide the injunction issue. So typically, when a temporary injunction is filed in a circuit court and it's an emergency injunction, the court would set a response from the other side and then would decide that emergency motion. Here, it's my understanding that the court did in fact ask for a response to that request for a temporary injunction, and filed was a fairly brief motion to dismiss. And then the court concluded that it should take up the motion to dismiss and the anonymity issue. It decided those, deciding that because your motion to dismiss involves the fact that you don't know who these people are, and because I'm saying the anonymity issue can't remain and these people need to disclose who they are, your motion to dismiss is denied. So those two motions were decided, right?
Right.
But remaining undecided was that initial temporary injunction relief request, right?
Yes.
Then when the anonymity issue and the motion to dismiss issue were decided by the court, you said, I'm seeking appellate review of that, and I would like to, and you kind of repackaged that first request into a relief pending appeal request, right?
Yes.
And then the court decided that relief pending appeal request, correct?
Right, yes.
granting what you wanted in part and denying what you wanted in part, right?
Yes.
But as I hear what you're saying in response to Justice Dalit, you're saying that really was the identical issue. It was just reframed in terms of pending appeal.
Yes.
So really, the issues have been fully briefed before the court.
Yes, the injunction pending appeal that we filed, literally I just copied and pasted the text of our original temporary injunction motion.
I looked at it.
The exact same motion.
But having said that, the one that you filed asking for emergency relief initially remains undecided. And how long has that been?
Yeah, 2.5 years since we filed this case. Yes, and that was an error by the circuit court itself. The circuit court should have heard the temporary injunction motion immediately, right away, and we would have been appealing that. The only reason we had to file a subsequent motion for injunction pending appeal is because the circuit court wouldn't hear our motion before this whole appeal on the anonymity issue went up and down. And the whole point of an injunction motion is to prevent harm while a case proceeds, and that's the position we've taken all along. We need an injunction to protect parents' rights, to protect children from harm while this case wends its way through the courts.
So you've repackaged it then as an injunction pending appeal. So when this appeal is over, the injunction is gone, is what I hear. That's what you've really repackaged this as.
But we also asked at the Court of Appeals, we said, in the alternative to an injunction pending appeal, if there is this time difference, we're also asking for a temporary injunction because don't lose track of the forest for the trees here. All we're asking for is an injunction while this case proceeds. So we asked the Court of Appeals for that, and it decided it. At appendix page 32 and 4, it indicated that we asked for a temporary injunction too, and the Court of Appeals said the outcome would be the same. Everybody agrees that the standard is the same, the test is the same, and so your request for that is also denied. So if you just send it back to the circuit court will say, I'm bound by the Court of Appeals decision, which decided that you don't get any sort of injunction, whether temporary injunction, injunction pending appeal, and then we just have to go through this whole appellate process all over again, and I'll be back here in a year making all the same arguments.
Let's talk about the anonymity issue a little bit. when it comes to anonymity, there are pseudonyms and there's anonymity. Which or both are you seeking? And importantly to that issue, are there any damages personal to these plaintiffs that are being sought? And is there any dispute that these plaintiffs are parents in the school district?
What we are asking, so I'll answer each one of those in turn. So what we are asking is that the plaintiffs can remain anonymous to all but the court. And that should be permitted here because their identities are completely irrelevant to this case. All we are challenging is the constitutionality of the district's policy. This is a purely legal question on whether a school district can exclude parents from this major decision. We're not seeking damages. We're not seeking any relief unique to the parents. We're solely asking for declaratory and injunctive relief against the district.
Well, the rule that you're asking us to make is that if there is a plaintiff in the lawsuit and the plaintiff in that lawsuit is making a purely legal claim, they should be able to file anonymously.
Not at all. No. No. What we are saying is in some cases, number one, in some cases, plaintiffs can remain anonymous. There is a presumption against anonymity, to be sure. But it can be overcome in the right case. So then the question is, when can it be overcome? What is the test? And this court has never considered that before, but federal courts around the country have. And they have a pretty unanimous balancing test, and they've come up with a list of factors to consider. And every single one of those factors weighs in favor of anonymity here.
And in those federal cases, Mr. Berg, and I know quite a bit about this, having done years of research trying to protect victims' anonymity in court cases in Wisconsin and beyond. The federal cases, I fear that you are conflating the use of pseudonyms with anonymity. And when I hear you use the word anonymity, or at least the way you are using it in this case, it is that no one knows who the people are who are filing this lawsuit except the judge and only the attorneys. And that is not actually in the cases that you cite and in the federal system what happens. What happens there is that people are given a pseudonym so that the greater public does not know who they are, but the judge most certainly does. And opposing counsel most certainly does. And when I say opposing counsel, I mean the opposing counsel team. Any co-counsel, anyone who is an intervener, anyone who is a paralegal who is working for them, because we operate under the presumption that attorneys take their oaths seriously. And in Wisconsin, under the Code of Professional Conduct, anyone who is an agent of an attorney is bound by the code. And if they aren't, it is the attorney who is held accountable.
You are correct that there are some cases like that where all that the plaintiffs ask for and get is a pseudonym. But there are other cases where courts have allowed plaintiffs to remain anonymous to all but the court. And we have an entire section of our brief where we list a bunch of those cases. And then the question for this court is that ever allowed? And I think, yes, it has to be. Certainly this court's inherent authority allows it to grant this request in some circumstances. And then the question is, when? What is the test for granting it? And federal courts have a list of factors that they consider, and every single one of those factors cuts in favor of anonymity here. We have minor plaintiffs. We have a very serious risk of retaliation or harassment against the plaintiffs. The circuit court found that as a factual matter, and there's no dispute about that in this case, that if their names become known, there's a serious risk of retaliation against them. This involves a very sensitive and controversial topic. The identities of the plaintiffs are completely irrelevant to the case. It's a purely legal issue, and there's no prejudice to the defense because who they are is totally irrelevant to whether the policy is unconstitutional.
So I didn't ever hear an answer to my third question, so I'm just trying to get that first. Is there any dispute that these are parents and children?
Not that I have heard so far. No, I have not heard the district say that it intends to dispute whether they are, in fact, parents. But if they do call that into question, there's a simple way to solve that, which is the plaintiffs can meet in chambers with the court, and the court can confirm that they are actually parents of children in the district.
Wait a minute. We're asking you, are the plaintiffs here parents who have children in the Madison Metropolitan School District?
Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood the question.
That
yes, they are.
That was not my question, actually. I'm not trying to be the trial judge here. I'm just wondering what the record is as to whether that's disputed, because that would be a standing issue, and that was what was brought up, at least in part, in the motion to dismiss, which was decided by the court.
Okay.
So I wondered what the state of the record was.
But are they
was.
Bound by your – see, that's the part where you say that they have no – that there's no need for them to know, okay? They have to accept your statement that they're parents, and they have to accept, and what about the irreparable harm piece? I go back to that, which I said before. Part of this injunction you're asking for is a showing that these particular individuals bringing this suit will be irreparably harmed while it's being decided, and yes, there's a constitutional issue, but in the meantime, that your clients are claiming that they're going to be irreparably harmed. How is the other side supposed to litigate irreparable harm if they don't even know who they are?
The harm that we are alleging does not depend on the identities of the plaintiffs in any way. The arguments for harm are based on the expert report that we submitted, that this is a serious issue, and if a school allows students to secretly transition without their parents knowing about it, it can do long-term harm to children.
In general, regardless of whether those parents actually have a child who this ever may affect. So you want that to be the way that a court decides? I mean, that's pretty easy, right? You want to say that's irreparable harm? There's a speculative chance that these parents might have a kid who might one day, might possibly go and have this issue come up for them and that the parents might not be notified?
The only possible way to prevent the harm is an injunction, because the district has said in its policy that it will hide from parents when this issue comes up.
I've got that policy in front of me. Where does it say hide? I've got it. I'm looking at the appendices to your brief. I'm starting on page 66. I do not see the word hide anywhere in it.
Appendix page 69, the third bullet down. Students will be called by their affirmed name and pronouns, regardless of parent guardian permission, to change their name and gender in MMSD systems.
Then how do you...
Let me keep going.
I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
Appendix page 66. School staff shall not disclose any information that may reveal a student's gender identity to others, including parents or guardians. And then on page appendix 68, it says, staff correspondence with parents shall reflect the name in students' records. This might involve using the student's affirmed name and pronouns in the school setting and their legal name and pronouns with family. So the school will use one name at school, And then when the parents show up at school, we'll switch back to a different name to hide this from parents. And if you look at the gender support plan, this is appendix pages 70 and 71, at the bottom of it, it says, please keep this interview in your confidential file, not in student records. That's a violation of the state records laws. And the whole point of that is to prevent parents from accessing this form so they can't find out what's happening at school.
The policy also says, doesn't it, on page... I'm looking on page, it says 71 to 74 at the top and appendix 69 at the bottom, so I'm not exactly sure which page numbering you're using. But it's on the top it says names and pronouns, and it says MMSD-based name change. MMSD students have the right to change their name and or gender in district systems, for example, Infinite Campus, to their affirmed name and pronouns with the permission of one parent or legal guardian.
Yeah, so let me read three bullets down is the first thing that I read. So what the district is doing here, and I'll explain why they're doing it this way, they say if you want to officially change your records, so we're going to change the system, the database, you need parental consent. The reason they have that in their policy is because that's required by federal law. Under FERPA regulations, only adult students or parents can request a change to records. But they say, we'll unofficially let students change their names, so you don't change the records, but every staff member is going to start referring to this child as the opposite sex. We can do that unofficially, and you don't need parent permission, and we'll actively hide this from your parents. And that's three bullets down. Students will be called by their affirmed name and pronouns, regardless of parent-guardian permission to change their name and gender in MMSD systems.
Counsel?
So that's they're trying to draw this very thin line that you need parent permission in official records, but you can do it secretly without parental notice or consent, unofficially, but it's only unofficial in the sense that it's not written down. So
this case is what I would call procedurally unusual. And one of the things that makes it procedurally unusual in my mind is the argument that is advanced by your opposing counsel on page 30 of the brief, which indicates there isn't jurisdiction to address the preliminary injunction. So I want to address that concern, counsel. They say on page 30 of the brief that indeed petitioners do not explain how this court could have jurisdiction over an issue the circuit court decided after the petitioners filed their notice of appeal. So what we have here is a notice of appeal that indicates only the anonymity issue, and you filed that, of course, on June 12th, it looks like. And it states that you are appealing the order entered on June 3rd. Now, that was the anonymity, not the dismissal. Of course, you wouldn't be appealing that. But June 3rd, the court handled the anonymity, and that's what you're saying is the subject of your appeal. And then in the narrative, you describe it as denied plaintiff's request to proceed anonymously. It wasn't, of course, until, I think, the 28th of September that the court entered an order with regard to injunction. And yet you never filed any kind of appeal of that issue, and that's the argument raised by your opposing counsel. Can you address that? Why, since the only issue that was appealed is the one on June 12th, several months before the court entered a subsequent order that was never appealed.
Yes, Your Honor. We moved for an injunction pending appeal at the circuit court, partially won, partially lost.
Yes.
Then we moved for an injunction pending appeal with the Court of Appeals. We did file a petition for review to this court from that decision, which was denied, I think, because of the rule from AR. And the rule from AR is you can't file a petition for review from a decision on a motion. But once the Court of Appeals issues its final decision on the merits of the issue on appeal, then all prior decisions issued by the Court of Appeals, including on motions, are presented to this court for jurisdictions. That's how I understand the rule from AR. So now that the Court of Appeals issued its decision on anonymity, both the injunction question and the anonymity question are both squarely presented to this court. And even if that wasn't clear under AR, this court in Univest held that this court has broad authority to review any prior decision of the Court of Appeals once it takes jurisdiction of a case, even a decision that could have been appealed separately but wasn't. There's a quote directly. I'll just read it. It says, "The authority of this court to consider issues addressed in earlier decisions of the Court of Appeals in the same case is broad, notwithstanding that review of the earlier decision is not sought."
Counsel, we have a tug on this court oftentimes, whether or not we should stay to the issues that are appealed and brought by counsel, or whether we go beyond that. And of course, we do both, depending on 1, 2, 3, 4 generally, sometimes 5, 6, and 7. So I note the opinion that you read, but I just say that there's, you know, a counter opinion too. So you think that there is jurisdiction even though the circuit court did not enter an order until months after your appeal was filed?
Yes, absolutely. And 809.14 says that the way to appeal is to file a motion in the Court of Appeals. We followed that process. And when we didn't get the relief we wanted from the Court of Appeals, we came to this court, and now we're here. There has to be a way to appeal to this court that question. The injunction question has been fully briefed and argued at every single level, and now we're asking for this court's review. So I think it's completely appropriate.
All right, thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. My name is Sarah Zylstra. I and Sarah Horner have the pleasure of representing the Madison School District. I want to apprise the court of how respondents are dividing their time. I'm going to take the first 15 minutes and focus solely on the anonymity issue. My counsel, Adam Prinsen, is going to take his 15 and focus on the injunction issues.
As it concerns the anonymity issue, do you have any concern that do you dispute or do you agree that these are parents of children in the school district?
I can do neither because I have anonymous affidavits. I take Luke Berg at his word because he is an officer of the court, but ours is an adversarial system, and unless I know who those are, I have no way to verify whether they are or they are not parents
of
the district.
So if he were to offer you a some sort of affidavit that these are parents of the school district, that would put his law license on the line. Would that satisfy you?
Your Honor, it's not a question of satisfying me. It's a question of satisfying, to me, the court and the judicial process of which we have.
They're not asking it be anonymous as to the court.
Correct, Your Honor, but the court has no way of knowing whether they are or are not parents of the district. That information resides with the district.
So what exactly are you seeking? Are you seeking to know who these people are, or do you just want to be able to question them under oath as to whether they are parents of children in the school district?
No, I'm seeking to know who they are because and I'll jump to what I think Your Honor is hinting at. There are three reasons why their identities are necessary for the defense. The first is for me to raise legal defenses. The second relates to ethical considerations. And the third relates that it's necessary for certain aspects of the facial challenge. I'll address each in turn. Starting with the legal defenses, there are a number of legal defenses that I cannot raise unless I know their actual identities. Ripeness, mootness, standing are the obvious ones. But how about the doctrine of release? Perhaps one of these parents has sued the district and entered into a covenant not to sue. That's one example of a defense that I would not be able to know. These parents might have a child that has what's called an IEP, They may have sought, their IEP may state that the child should be called a certain name or with by a certain pronoun, and they may have had a due process challenge in front of an ALJ. That might bring up issues of waiver, estoppel, claim preclusion, issue preclusion. None of those things can I evaluate without knowing the identities of who they are. The second reason is...
You don't see these as broad challenges to the policy. You see these as specific challenges relating to damage done to these particular people.
I'm saying that these facts and these defenses would be relevant to any sitting judge trying to decide these issues. It may be, for example, Your Honor, that none of the plaintiffs have the ability to challenge the policy due to these principles. I can't know that unless I know their identities.
Okay. But these people are not seeking damages particular to them.
I agree they're not seeking damages, but one of the other elements, for example, might be costs. I have the ability to tax costs. I don't know how I tax costs if I don't know the identities of the plaintiffs.
I'm interested in knowing the
other...
Well,
you could always cross that bridge when you get to it, right?
We could, Your Honor. We could, Your Honor.
I'm interested in knowing the other two. What you need to know their name. Legal defenses, what were two and three?
The second thing is ethical constraints. Ethical constraints, and we'll start with conflicts of interest. When we raised the idea of needing their identities for conflicts of interest below, two petitioners immediately were dismissed from the lawsuit. Why? Because there were actual conflicts of interest with the Boardman law firm. Now, plaintiff's counsel says, well, he can police the conflicts. But as this court knows, conflicts of interest reside with the attorney that's responsible with respect to that client. I have ethical duties, and with respect to Mr. Berg, he cannot police my ethical duties. I have the responsibility, too. Mr. Berg had talked about waiving conflicts, but that's my responsibility to address the pros and cons of any waiver argument. Second to that is let's focus on recusal. Now,
how would there ever be someone anonymous in a lawsuit? That can't ever exist, then, under that logic.
Well, Your Honor, I'll say this with respect to anonymous litigation. I don't think that's an issue this court has to decide today. This court has been operating, I believe, since 1853. In 169 years, I have never seen an appellate case where there has been someone who's been anonymous litigation.
Well, we've had John Doe cases for sure.
Sure.
In fact, we had the Archdiocese cases in 2005 and 2007. We had some cases dealing with blood type issues in 1993. There have been John Doe cases before, and they have proceeded without people really arguing about what's appropriate concerning anonymity and being able to address the appropriate issues. What I hear you arguing is a case can never truly be anonymous because you can't address your conflict of interest issues.
Your Honor, I never say never, so I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying I'm not aware of any appellate case where this has been the issue. I don't know in those cases whether they were anonymous from the defense counsel as opposed to just using pseudonyms or as opposed to just being anonymous from the public.
Well, typically these cases like the Archdiocese ones and whatnot are where people are seeking money damages based upon the damage to them from the person they're suing. So obviously they're more personal in nature regarding that. This is more of a broad constitutional claim that this policy is something that is unconstitutional and perhaps violates statutes. So it would be potentially as to a very broad group of people who could bring this lawsuit. But you're saying no one could ever bring it anonymously. They would have to have their name in the public domain.
Your Honor, I won't say never say never, but I will say that this state favors disclosure with the least restrictive means necessary to protect the plaintiffs. In this case,
what would you propose to protect these plaintiffs? To make sure they're protected in this instance, what would you agree to or what would you propose to the court?
I would say two things, Your Honor. One, that was being worked on as the appeal got filed.
Well, I don't want settlement negotiations.
I'm looking
for a legal standard. What is the legal standard that we would, let's just assume some of my colleagues think anonymity is the only issue. We're going to send it back and the trial court can use its discretion. I'm just assuming that. It's a hypothetical. But let's say that's what we're doing. if that's what the court would do, what should the trial court be thinking about to adequately protect these people?
And Your Honor, forgive me because I wasn't clear. That's a protective order. And that terms of the protective order need to be presented to the trial court with argument favoring or not, arguing against whatever the provisions are in the protective order. What I was trying to suggest is that we had not fully developed that process. We did not get before the court on an argument with respect to what the terms of the protective order should or shouldn't be. And that's the reason why I believe this is a premature issue for this court until we get that resolved.
Well, but what is it you're proposing? I'm just trying to figure out what you need and how that's best addressed.
The trial court issued them to file an amended complaint under seal, attorney's eyes only provision. I believe that is sufficient to address the privacy concerns of the plaintiffs.
Part of the concern for me, you know, I'm thinking through it both as a lawyer who litigated, like, trade secret and things like that where you don't want that in the public domain. You can have attorney's eyes only. You can stamp that on documents. You can do a lot of different things in cases. Trial judges can do a lot of things with protective orders. But in this particular case, I'm just trying to think through how sealing the case from the public view, that's a whole different animal. I mean, the public has the right to see what the complaint is, what the answer is, what the judge is deciding, when the hearings are going to be had. That belongs in the public domain.
Are you asking for the whole case to be sealed or just the names?
Just the names. Just the names.
So they would proceed under pseudonyms the way you understand the 169 years of appellate cases have been that have addressed this.
Well, then that's not really sealing the file. That is issuing a protective order or using pseudonyms.
Correct, Your Honor.
That's not sealing a file. Sealing a file removes it from the public domain.
When you're talking about sealing under 801, are you talking about sealing the names?
Let me clarify, at least as I understood as how this would work at the trial court. They would file an amended complaint under seal that would have no redactions whatsoever. That complaint would go only attorney's eyes only to the parties. I think the court would likely require them to file a redacted version of the complaint that would eliminate the names. The redacted version of the complaint would be the public-facing document that would basically preclude the public from seeing their names, but would see the general provisions of the complaint.
Do you envision the amended complaint would have any different causes of action than the one that's currently filed?
I don't know, Your Honor. To be honest, with respect to Mr. Berg, his allegations with respect to what the injunctions should look like have morphed a little bit over time, and so therefore I think it's possible that there might be other causes of action, but I don't know.
There was a third point that you wanted to make before you run out of time.
Yeah, why it's important for the scope of the injunction and the facial challenge. There may be factual scenarios that are relevant to whether or not there's a facial challenge, and let me remind the court that a facial challenge requires the petitioner to prove that the policy in question can't be constitutionally enforced under any circumstance. So the question is, are there factual circumstances where their identities might matter that would be brought up by the defense on a facial challenge? Answer is yes. Here's some examples. One of these parents may have a child who's a senior in high school but just turned 18. The parents then, we believe, would not be appropriate plaintiffs in that circumstances. Another might be a parent whose parental rights have been terminated by a court, whether they have the ability to bring the challenge or not. The plaintiffs contend this is medical care. If so, in custody cases, oftentimes one parent may be given the right to be making medical decisions for the child, and the other parent may have lost that right. With respect to IEPs and whether or not there is a provision with respect to calling a child by a specific pronoun or not, even if parents share joint legal custody, for parental consent for special education services, a school district can proceed with only one parent's consent. And so you could have a case where the parents don't agree. And these are all circumstances, and there are lots of others where it might be helpful and it might be necessary for our defense to have some of those facts. And I'd like to also switch and make two points on with respect to this issue. This is a preliminary injunction motion, or at least that was one of the motions that are coming up before the court. Oftentimes, if a court is going to grant...
Do you agree the preliminary injunction motion is properly before this court?
No, Your Honor, and I leave that to Attorney Princhin to dissect. But With respect to preliminary injunctions, the court typically orders the scope of the relief that's specific to the plaintiffs. So if we knew their identity, likely the court would enter an injunction, if plaintiffs won, that would say with respect to these parents, the school district has an obligation to tell them if their child engages in behavior that's described. What they're asking for is a preliminary injunction de facto, and that could infringe upon other parents' rights.
I'd like to go back to the entire rationale underlying the petitioner's request for anonymity. They are concerned that there will be leaks and that the parents and or the children could be subjected to harassment or even violence. In fact, I will point out that due in no small part to a leak out of all places, the United States Supreme Court and amici in this case had Molotov cocktails thrown through its window. So are you suggesting that this court should not be concerned about protecting the identity of the petitioners in this case under such threats of violence?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm suggesting that in this case, the trial court considered that and fashioned an appropriate remedy, and that's an exercise of discretion that this court should affirm. I will say two things with respect to that question, Your Honor. First, Mr. Berg has already said it's not a question of personal trust. He believes that the attorneys in this case will honor the protective order, and it'd be different if he had facts to suggest that one of us have not followed a protective order in the past. There's no factual basis to suggest we're not going to honor.
I would expect the attorneys would as well, and I wanted to clarify that point. Are you suggesting then that I hate to use the word compromise because this court will not get involved with whatever agreements you may reach as counsel, but attorneys' eyes only, to you, does that mean attorneys only, excluding paralegals and legal assistants and secretaries and people who otherwise work in law firms?
I think those terms of the protective order can be presented to the trial court, and the trial court can rule on that issue, and it hasn't. But from my perspective, I don't think it's fair to hinder myself saying my legal assistant and my paralegal can't see those names. I dictate. Does this mean every time I dictate something that I can't have my secretary type it because it might contain a name? If I'm dictating questions relating to a deposition that I might take or whatnot, it's an unfair intrusion into my practice of law without a factual basis. And your decision in Builder said it has to be actual facts, not speculation, not hypothetical facts.
Is it your position that any injunction would have to be specific to these?
Your Honor, my red light is on. May I answer your question?
You can answer my question.
Thank you. And I'm sorry, Your Honor, could you repeat it?
That's okay. I'll ask the injunction question later.
Thank you, Your Honor.
In fact, we can start with that one as soon as counsel gets up here.
May it please the court. My name is Adam Prinsen, along with my colleague Emily Feinstein, on behalf of Respondents, Gender Equity Association of Memorial High School, and Gender Sexuality Alliance at both West and La Follette High School. Your Honors, I would like to make 3 points today on the injunction issue. First, petitioners never appealed the stay of the injunction hearing, and in fact, the trial court never ruled on the preliminary injunction.
When did the trial court issue a decision staying the initial request for temporary injunction? That was well beyond 90 days of that matter being filed and your answer, which was a motion to dismiss, right?
Your Honor, it was 4 months after the notice of appeal that brings us here today was filed.
Are you familiar with judges' obligations to decide motions within 90 days?
Yes, Your Honor, but that was stayed given the motion to dismiss that was filed.
When was that stay entered?
The stay, which stay, Your Honor?
The one you're talking about, staying some obligation to decide a motion where it was filed, the court set an opportunity for proper response.
The choice of counsel was to file as a response a motion to dismiss, and nothing else was filed until a second motion for temporary injunction pending appeal was filed, at which time you then chose to brief or respond to that motion. But the first one was filed. The choice to answer in the way it was answered was done, and it sat for a long time.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, to answer your question in terms of the timing, the district moved to dismiss the complaint and oppose petitioner's motion for anonymity or to proceed using pseudonyms on March 11th. So it was after that point that the court stayed all other proceedings to decide the motion to dismiss, Your Honor, and then heard the anonymity motion next in line on May 26th. It was June 12th, so less than 90 days after that, that the petitioners moved for a stay to not file their amended complaint under Steele. And it was at petitioners' request for a stay that the proceedings were stopped at the trial court level, all happening within 90 days of the decision on the motion to dismiss.
So a pending motion can just sit there and be filed, responded to, and then the court several months later can issue a stay of choosing to decide that.
Who asked for the stay again?
Petitioners asked for the stay, Your Honor. So petitioners requested the stay because they did not wish to file the amended complaint under seal, identifying themselves to the court and opposing counsel.
I'm talking about we're missing each other. Complaints filed almost contemporaneous with the complaint is a request for emergency relief, which in a bunch of cases is decided promptly. And then we know that because they're appealed here all the time. Mask mandates, a lot of cases, Act 10, a lot of cases get appealed here because temporary injunctive relief is sought and it's answered promptly by a trial court. The trial court presumably knew that because it said, please file a response to this. And your choice was to file a motion to dismiss. The trial court didn't decide that emergency injunctive relief. If the new standard in the law is counsel should file a motion to dismiss and you never get your emergency relief decided by a trial court, that will be a change in the way Wisconsin law has been working. At least this court's had to deal with a lot of hot issues decided on temporary injunctive relief.
I have two responses to that, Your Honor. First, Wisconsin Statute 802.06 stays for 180 days, all other motions filed pending a motion to dismiss.
Okay, I hear you, but the motion to dismiss, at least in my practice as a lawyer and as a trial judge, often can be in response to a complaint. It can come up as part of the proceeding. The logic there is you stay all the expensive discovery while you're figuring out whether or not this case survives. It doesn't. I haven't really seen it used in the context of someone asking for emergency injunctive relief, and that request gets ignored while a motion to dismiss is entertained. Can you tell me any other cases where you're familiar with that being the posture?
Not offhand with respect to the cases, Your Honor, but I do want to say respectfully, the trial court did not ignore petitioner's motion for a preliminary injunction. We're in a unique situation here. As my co-counsel just argued to the court, petitioners moved to move forward in this case anonymously. And it was that piece that prevented the court from being able to hear adequately the preliminary injunction motion. So again, it's because of these unique circumstances. Judge Remington did not ignore the request for a preliminary injunction.
So what changed when the court did decide the virtually exact same motion, but it was limited to the time for appeal? What changed there that made the court able to decide it?
Well, the court had set a hearing date for the preliminary injunction, had set a schedule for briefing, and it had set...
Are you talking about the one pending appeal, not the one that was filed?
Right before that, he had set the preliminary injunction motion and then had ordered petitioners to file an amended complaint under seal in order for us to proceed toward that preliminary injunction hearing. and petitioners did not want to disclose their identity. So at that time, they appealed that order by the court and then filed their motion for an injunction pending appeal.
Okay. And what I heard you say was the court couldn't decide the first injunction because the court didn't know who the parties were.
Yes, Your Honor. And that is why the court ordered that it was a grant in part and a denial in part.
The court did hear and decide the identical motion, but it was just limited to on appeal later. So the court then had all the information it needed, but the court didn't have it previously? That's what you're saying?
Respectfully, Your Honor, at the time the court decided the injunction pending appeal, we did not know anything about the plaintiff's identities, which is why the court decided the injunction pending appeal the way the court did. If petitioners were to try to obtain the full relief or request for relief via the injunction that they are asking this court for today, we would have had to have known their identities in order to conduct discovery. So the court found that there was no irreparable harm because we did not have that information, and the court did not have that information at that time. So the court decided what it could with respect to the limited injunction. If petitioners continue to press for the ultimate relief that they seek in this case through this preliminary injunction, they needed to follow the court's order and file their amended complaint, identify themselves under seal so that we could have proceeded under the schedule set by the trial court for the preliminary injunction. So the trial court did decide what was effectively, as petitioners have put it, in an identical motion for an injunction, but made clear in adequately explaining his reasons in the record that he found no irreparable harm because we did not know the identity of the plaintiff. Therefore, there was no evidence put forth showing that they had irreparable harm specifically as to them.
Doesn't that conflict with federal law, though? The petitioners have cited federal cases saying that when constitutional rights are threatened or impaired, irreparable injury is presumed, so the identity of the petitioners is irrelevant, isn't it?
Respectfully, Your Honor, the cases cited by petitioners in support of that notion are First Amendment cases. We do not have First
Difference
Amendment.
Difference does it make? We're talking about the fundamental parental right to raise children, to direct their upbringing and their education, and to ensure that their lives comport with their religious beliefs. Those are pretty weighty issues and constitutionally protected rights just as much as the First Amendment.
Your Honor, while there is a right to the upbringing of your children, the right at stake here is not defined in the courts and does not exist here. We're talking about the school respecting a decision of a child to go by a different name or set of pronouns at school and respecting that confidentiality. The school is not intervening in the home. The school is not, as in many cases cited by petitioners, requiring custody situations or grandparents to have to visit, like the ALL case that this court decided just a few years ago with respect to that right.
Can I just try to get an answer and then hand it right back? But do you agree or disagree there's a constitutional right to parent your own children?
There is a constitutional right to the upbringing, care, and custody of your child.
Do you agree or disagree that the parents act in the best interests of their children?
There is a presumption that parents act in the best interest of their children, but those rights are not implicated in this particular situation, Your Honor.
I'm not sure how you can say that because at the most extreme example presented by the petitioners, the school could facilitate a gender transition for a child and completely hide this from the parents, and the parents just don't get to have any say or knowledge in it. And I think it was one of the amicus briefs who basically said, well, that's the parents' problem for not paying enough attention. But here we have parents who are really paying attention to what is going on in the schools, and those parental rights do not exist just in the home, right? You're not arguing, are you, counsel, that when children set foot in schools, that the government then overrides parental interests and decision-making? You're not arguing that, are you?
Not in every circumstance in schools, Your Honor. No, I'm not arguing that. However, in this case, your point highlights the factual disputes that remain and the merits in this case that the trial court was never able to hear. There is factual disputes, even amongst the experts of the two parties today, whether going by a different name or set of pronouns at school even indicates in the first part gender exploration, and in the second part any sort of social transition in the first
place. The factual disputes among the experts or self-styled experts on either side really don't matter because we're talking about constitutional rights, and those constitutional rights are not modified by what experts think, right?
Your Honor, again, in this case, the constitutional right is not implicated here. The school district is not preventing these parents from speaking to their children, is not preventing their parents in any way, shape, or form from taking their children to be evaluated by a therapist, psychiatrist, psychologist, or meet with another medical profession. The school is not, in fact, doing anything directly at all here. And I would like to remind Your Honors that the trial court explained its reasoning on the injunction piece here and has not had a full opportunity to hear the merits on the preliminary injunction. And I urge this court to please follow the normal course of procedure.
But the normal course of procedure is not to force litigants to wait over 2 years to get a decision from the trial court. And I understand and completely, as my colleagues do, that this is a procedurally complex case and fingers can be pointed in both directions as to why there is delay. But 2 years, over 2 years, when this court takes jurisdiction over a case, we take jurisdiction over all the issues presented. And I'd like you to address your friend on the other side's argument that all of the issues have been fully briefed. So why can this court not decide the issues since they're here? I mean, isn't that best for the parties? Isn't that best for judicial efficiency and economy to not send this back again when we know, regardless of what decision the circuit court makes, it's going to work its way through the appellate process again? It's here. Why don't we decide it?
Your Honor, to your point about the 2 years, petitioners themselves waited 2 years after this guidance was adopted by the school district, which is a stark reason as to why entering an injunction at this point would change the status quo. And second, Your Honor, this has not been fully argued or fleshed out amongst the parties, respectfully, Your Honor. We have not had the preliminary injunction hearing. We have not been able to gather evidence to build our defense. As the trial court pointed out in his well-reasoned decision, if allowing this injunction to be entered at this point in time while petitioners remain anonymous would effectively convert this case into a de facto class action. And that is not what we have here, Your Honor.
Counsel, you had raised three issues I thought that you were going to address at the beginning. I think you got to the first one, and I just want to make sure you had an opportunity to hit all the points you wanted to make.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. The first point was that the appeal of the injunction is not appropriately in front of this court, as Justice Bradley had commented on earlier. The second was that the trial court did not abuse its discretion. Whether this court agrees with the entry of the injunction, the partial injunction that the trial court entered, is of no part in that the court effectively exercised its discretion, explained the elements that it was addressing with respect to the injunction that it entered appropriately, and this court should not disturb that decision. And the last point I wanted to make is that petitioners have mischaracterized the guidance of the school district. The school district encourages parental or familial involvement. In supplemental appendix page 21, page 16 of the guidance, it explains and highlights that parental involvement is important, and the school will do everything it can to encourage that as appropriate. I see I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Your Honors, what we are talking about here is an experiment, a grand social experiment. Never before in the history of humanity have we on such a large scale treated little boys as if they're girls and little girls as if they're boys.
Okay, Mr. Berg,
now,
Mr. Berg, I would like you to focus on this case and not pontificate about something much larger. I noticed you did not mention 801.21 sub 4, which is the law in this state, which talks about restricting access in the least restrictive means to achieve the purpose of the rule and the needs of the requester. I did not find one cite to that in any of your briefs. Can you please address that?
I will, but I just want to finish the point that I was making.
Well, I would like you to answer my question.
I'd like to hear the point he was making.
Well, this is an experiment that is being conducted on children. And
What's the experiment?
The experiment is treating children as if they're the opposite sex, and parents have a right to decide whether they want their children to be a part of this experiment or not.
Okay, can you now answer my question?
And the injunction that we're asking here is perfectly tailored to the harm. All we're asking is if this issue arises while this case proceeds, defer to parents. That's all we're asking. Okay? If a kid wants to transition at school, defer to the parents. Let the parents decide. For some kids, it may be right. For others, it may not. But parents know their kids best. They love their kids best. They're going to be most zealous for what is best for their children. They need to be the ones to decide this issue. That's all we're asking for. Now, to your question, we absolutely address that in our briefing.
Listed once in the beginning of your brief, and I didn't find it in your reply brief. I didn't see. So where did you address it exactly?
We are not asking that the whole case be sealed. We're not asking that any of the arguments or briefing be hidden from the public. The only thing we're asking is that the parents' identities be kept from the public and only given to the court because they are completely irrelevant to the case.
And you're saying it's least restrictive to not even give it to the attorneys despite there being no appellate case in 169 years to do
that.
Yes,
it is the least restrictive means to protect them from the risk of leaks, from the serious risk of retaliation that they face if their names become known. And the district hasn't been able to give you any good, real reason why they need to know their identity.
Well, I haven't heard a good reason why you think that the lawyers in this case won't make every effort to preserve the plaintiff's anonymity and follow a court order, which is specifically what you said to the trial court when you were asked about this. Do you want us to assume that there's going to be a breach on behalf of the attorneys?
We did have a debate with the trial court. We had a long discussion about the scope of a protective order, and the scope of the protective order that the circuit court was contemplating would require disclosure to every attorney for three large law firms, every paralegal, every intern,
every
investigator.
Was that ever decided?
That was decided, yes.
By the trial court?
Yes.
Your friends on the other side say that the scope of that protective order was
not. Yeah, that was not true, what they said.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
All right, but you want us to assume that the attorneys are going, that they are going to leak it, that the attorneys are going to leak it, or that their agents are going to leak it such that the attorney's license is at stake. That's the step you need us to make to show that this is the least restrictive
means. If their names are disclosed to thousands of people.
Thousands of people?
Any attorney, any staff member, any intern, any investigator they hire of three large law firms, the total number of lawyers alone is about 1,000 people. We're talking about the ACLU, Quarles and Brady, and Boardman Clark. That's a very large group of people. So if one person leaks their name to the public, what remedy do they have? There's no way to undo that, and there's no reason whatsoever to impose that risk on the plaintiffs when their identities are totally irrelevant to the constitutionality of the district's policy. That's the only issue in the case. That's the only issue we're raising. We're not making any allegations about our plaintiffs. And we told the other side from the beginning of the case, if you want to know anything about the plaintiffs, just ask us. We'll tell you anything you want to know. You want to know whether they have an IEP? Ask us. We'll tell you. You want to know whether the parents are still together? Ask us. We'll tell you. They had 7 months from the time we filed the case until the injunction hearing was heard, and the circuit court was very clear that discovery was not stayed, and they didn't ask for a single thing.
What's the limiting principle on what you're asking us to do here, Mr. Berg? To let people bring lawsuits for the very first time in Wisconsin, not telling the attorneys on the other side their names. Tell me the limiting principle.
I want this court to hold that this is possible in some cases, and I want this court to say what the factors are for when this is allowed. And the factors to use are the ones that federal courts around the country have used. And if you go through those factors, every single one of those factors cuts in favor of anonymity here.
If the court were to decide to not adopt or use or analyze the federal factors and just send this back to the trial court, wouldn't the real remedy be for future litigants to just go to federal court and have federal courts be the decider of state law issues?
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's a huge concern here. If this court says this is never possible, litigants will have to go to federal court.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
All right. Interesting oral arguments. We appreciate your briefing and spending time with us to answer our questions here today. The court will convene in closed conference. Yeah, I hope you're feeling better, whoever and however. Yep, no problem.
We love having oral arguments on tough cases at the end of May. Have a good day. It's all good.
Yeah, how you doing? It's been a while. Hey, nice job.
He said he's going to be right on.